down trends.
Is the singularity here?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
He is God's, you know, catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed split level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The Chinese government has executed tens of thousands of prisoners to harvest their organs. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is a problem that most of us in the West aren't even aware exists. But those of us whose jobs it is to know are pretending that they don't know. The topic of conversation here on the program for the next 2 weeks will be a new documentary film, clocking in at just under an hour, but it documents one of the most horrific phenomena, one of the most horrific abuses by any government going on in the world today. The name of the film is Hard to Believe. And before we get into the meat of the conversation today, watch this.
I was in Beijing when the crackdown occurred. Watched it happen. Pretended to be a tourist, a lost tourist, and watched old ladies get thrown into buses.
I didn't know what I was seeing. I found it very disturbing.
This huge population, extremely vulnerable. Family didn't know where they were. Jailers didn't know who they were. And they became this just vast sea of expendable humanity.
The year was 2005. A patient of mine came to me one day and told me, "Doc, I have to tell you that I was scheduled to undergo heart transplantation on a specific date." And I looked at him and I said, "How can they schedule a heart transplant ahead of time 2 weeks?"
I was in the labor camp, the Tangshan labor camp in Beijing for 3 years. Every 3 months, we got a blood test.
An eye test, and a kidney test, everything.
No one in the mainstream press that have offices inside China are covering it inside China. And they're missing the story of what is one of the most catastrophic human rights violations in our time.
After I left China and my perspective totally changed, then I said, "Oh my God, I committed a crime."
Our guest tonight is the producer of the film. She has spent some time researching this project. She's also involved in a second film that we may touch on during the course of the conversation. She is the producer for this film, works for Swoop Films in New York, which has released the documentary Hard to Believe. We welcome Kate Rubicek to the program. Kate, thank you for joining us.
Right.
I think the movie is aptly titled because when we describe what is going on, most people say, "Well, I find that hard to believe. I can't believe that this actually happens, that a government that seeks to present itself as enlightened and world-class as the Chinese government is actually using prisoners of conscience as raw material for live organ harvesting."
Yes, they are. And that is the biggest problem, is that the issue is so hard to believe. And that's one of the reasons why it hasn't had a lot of the traction that it should have had. It's not a new story. This has been going on for a long time. And I first learned about this in 2006. So I've been following the story since then. And during that time, there's been so much evidence, and a recent report that came out by some investigators, you know, who were in the film, that came out just a month or two ago, is they said there's not a lack of evidence. The problem is there's so much evidence. And for, you know, there's been books written about this topic now. There's been movies made about it. There's documentary here about it. But the problem is that there is a lot of evidence, but people are still just putting it in the too hard basket. It's too hard to believe. It's too difficult to deal with China. They're putting it into that category, and they're pushing it aside because it's a big can of worms. But when you can break through that issue, so many things can be resolved. So it's an issue that's really important to tackle, and it's one that really affects us here, as well as, you know, all other countries, not just China.
You've been aware of this since 2006. Again, most people aren't even aware that it is going on at all. Why is there this wall of silence that separates the activity of the Chinese government from the rest of the world?
Good question. And that's really what the documentary Hard to Believe looks at, is we didn't just go into trying to prove or disprove, is this happening or not? We really, after Ken Stone, the director, really got involved in this and started investigating, and he had no idea that this was going on prior to working on this documentary, just a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. So it was really great to be working with someone like Ken and also Irene Silver. She was another producer on the film. And neither of them had any knowledge before about this going on. And so they really wanted to take the approach of finding out, why do people not know about it? What is that wall of silence? And a number of things we came up with. I mean, the biggest issue is that it's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that doctors are cutting up people while they're alive, mm-hmm. and selling their organs for profit. And these are not criminal prisoners. The biggest issue is they are not... We don't want to do it from criminal prisoners either, but these are not even criminal prisoners. They've done nothing wrong. So being hard to believe is the first topic, the first reason. But there's also these political reasons that have come in. There's this, the majority of the people that are being used as having their organs removed are people who practice Falun Gong. Mm-hmm. It's a spiritual meditation practice in China that grew hugely popular. But the then president wanted to eradicate it because he felt it was a threat to atheism in communist China.
Right.
So he's a very traditional group that has traditional beliefs, but atheists, communism is essentially atheism. They didn't want that. And it was really that dictator, Jiang Zemin. He went against the whole faction to bring about the persecution. But these people, there's just so many of them. They're rounding them up into prisons and keeping them in jail, and they couldn't get rid of them. So one of the biggest, to maintain this persecution against peaceful people, the Chinese Communist Party had to do something. So what they've done is they've created this whole field of lies and propaganda around to sustain this persecution. And that has spread outside of China to America. That's spread out to all the governments. So even though people will see Falun Gong practitioners or see the exercises and see that it's harmless or even beneficial, they are getting this propaganda from the Chinese government. They get threats and coercion saying that you cannot deal with these people because otherwise we won't deal with you. And that kind of threat has caused a lot of confusion because people in the media and government, they've said to others, we don't know who to believe. We hear information from people who practice Falun Gong, and we hear information from the Chinese government, and very few people have stood in the middle to say, I don't practice Falun Gong and I'm not part of the government, but I think you should stop this. Hmm. Ethan Gutman, the author of The Slaughter, David Matus and David Kilgore, they're all independent researchers, lawyers, authors. David Kilgore is a former Secretary of State in Canada. They independently stepped forward, and so they have been very remarkable in being able to bring this issue forward not on behalf of the victim community, but on behalf of the international community. But it's really difficult when there's not many of those types of people stepping forward, and the others who should be doing something are on either side, or feeling that they don't know who to believe because there's just this propaganda constantly coming out. And the Chinese Communist Party has turned this into a political issue, unfortunately, which it shouldn't be. It should be a human rights issue.
Now, I used the figure tens of thousands at the opening of the program. Is that an accurate number? And how do we know, where does this estimate come from?
Good question. That estimate came from research that had been done. And published in, it's about three books now, The Slaughter, and then another book, Bloody Harvest, written by David Matus, David Kilgore, and there was another book, State Organs, that was compiled by David Matus and Torsten Trey, who runs the non-governmental organization called Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting. So those figures had been those researchers independently came to similar figures, you know, somewhere we're between, I think Ethan Gutman had set up to, you know, between 40 to 60,000 over an 8-year period. Now, more evidence has surfaced this year since Hard to Believe had been released, and the latest figures that Ethan Gutman and David Matus, David Kilgore have released is that by investigating the amounts of transplants being done in hospitals currently in China, that we're looking at more like 100,000 a year.
100,000 a year?
A year.
Whoa.
Now, when you think about that amount, in China, there were up to, the government estimates were up to 100 million Falun Gong practitioners were practicing in 1999. Now, after that, Ethan Gutman's, after his research into the Chinese labor camp system, said that at any point in time, there's 500,000 to 1 million Falun Gong practitioners in prison at any point in time.
Huh.
So these numbers are huge, but China's huge. The problem's huge. But we're talking about individual human beings here. But when you look at the numbers, it's big, right? It's big. They're the numbers that they're playing with, and they don't want anyone to just go and multiply it, because when you multiply it, it becomes phenomenal. But they are just looking at the hospitals in China, how many transplants they are performing a year, and they're saying it's you know, around 100,000 transplants a year. And now China has a very small voluntary donor system.
Mm-hmm.
It's in its infancy. It's only just started. It was not around in 2006. It was not around when Falun Gong practitioners first started being persecuted and being used for this. So it's very small. The organ donors are very small. Traditionally, Chinese don't do that. So they don't donate their organs. They want their body to be kept whole when they pass away. So criminal prisoners, China's admitted that they kill their prisoners for organs. And they don't distinguish between criminal prisoners and political prisoners or prisoners of conscience. But the criminal prisoners, there's a very high rate of hepatitis B. There's a high, you know, it's difficult to match and find healthy people for organs from certain ages, especially across all ages. So there is, unfortunately, this huge organ donor bank, which they have. They've even gone into homes. This is something that we didn't report in the film, and we haven't. But there has been reports coming out of China. We didn't include it in the film because it was hard to get more, you know, tangible evidence. But we do have reports of people in their homes who practice Falun Gong that have had police force their way in and take swabs from their tissue from their mouth so that they could be entered onto this database.
That sounds like something from a horror film.
It is a horror film. I mean, when you think about it, right, they're using I talked to a doctor recently, and he said that another doctor had told him that he needed there was a burns victim, and this is a case in China. There was someone that had serious burns, suffered serious burns all over the body, and he was able to get a full skin, because when you have serious burns, if you put grass skins from other part of the body, then it helps to heal.
Mm-hmm.
But this person was able to receive a full human skin to size over their body, and it had a miraculous healing effect, because that's what it does. But how do you get it?
How do you get where? Who? Yeah. Who? Oh.
This is what people are getting, and when you look at one thing, organ donation. There's organ donation, and it's people are, it's a serious issue because people need organs. But then you also look at the medical research that are being done, the studies that are being done. They are finding so many ways in China to use the human body because they do not value the lives of these people.
It's a utilitarian view of human life.
Very much, very much. And that's something that I think we as people have to make a choice on. Do we accept that or not? And do we want that from our neighbors? And if we know our neighbors are doing that, are we going to say something? Or are we just going to pretend that we don't know that they're doing that right next door? Because we are in a global community. They are right next door to us. We're buying products from them. We're traveling there. We're training their doctors here to do that. There are colleagues here that have told me, I've said, you know, we've spoken to them and said, hard to believe, here's the film. Would you like it for your college? Yes, we want it. And then they come back and say, I'm sorry, we have too many teachers, students and teachers and doctors here from China. We are afraid to show the film because we're afraid we might upset them.
Mm.
And I've had other ethicists, other colleges say to me, you should tell them that that is not ethical. And that this film is a good way for people to introduce it to students, to introduce it to Chinese people, to introduce it to educators, give them the tool to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be a taboo topic. It should be something that people can talk about it and just be able to bring up over conversation and say, well, I don't think that should be happening. The same way we bring up any abuse happening anywhere in the world. Anyway, that's...
Yeah. Now, as a Christian, I obviously have a certain view of human life, which is that as we are created as God's imagers, not necessarily in his image, but his imagers, his agents, moral agents on earth, there is a certain value to human life regardless of our limitations or handicaps. And so it should be protected regardless of you know, whether the person is a political prisoner or a criminal prisoner or not. I mean, I'm not opposed to punishments for certain crimes, but still, that is something to be taken very seriously. You don't take a human life just because this person disagrees with your political philosophy and someone else has need for that, with the same blood type, needs a kidney. I just ran some rough numbers here, which is why I was looking away from the camera for a couple of moments and just pulled up very quickly on an internet search. Rough numbers. If a kidney, black market kidney, and I don't know how this is, and I'll ask you this in just a moment, but black market kidney in China, roughly $60,000.
Yes.
If that's 100,000 of them a year, you're talking $60 billion in revenue.
Yes. They're making hotels next to the transplant hospitals to be able to house the patients so they can move them out of the hospital beds and get more people into the beds. It's there. If you have a look at that report that came out, I think it was June or July this year, an update. It's called Bloody Slaughter, Bloody Harvest / The Slaughter, an update. So it's an update on those two books presented by both sets of authors. It's available free online at a website called endorganpillaging.org. And you can see in there the raw data that they've gathered from sources all across China, and the transplant hospitals. They have photos of these hospitals, and the size of them, the amount of money that is going into this, it is not something that's stopping. On one side, the transplantation community, that they've had some pressure put on them to try and do something to stop it. But they're right. They feel responsible that they have to help China use the tools and know how to use the tools and work with them. But unfortunately, it's not making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
China is saying, well, we're not using executed prisoners anymore, but they're not saying who they're using where these organs are coming from. And on the other hand, we see these hospitals are booming,
mm-hmm.
absolutely booming. The industry is not about to close down. Absolutely not. They are building these hospitals, and they have been building them,
yeah.
especially since 1999 when the crackdown on the Falun Gong practice started. And that's when they were doing it before in small amounts for certain people who needed an organ. They could order it through the prison system. But at that point, that's when it began to skyrocket, and it doesn't look like it's slowing down.
Mm. When you start with a premise that the only life that you have is the one that, you know, in this time-space continuum, if you don't believe in an afterlife, then you feel justified in using any means necessary to extend that. I don't have a problem with people. You know, I've known family members who died for lack of available transplant organs. So, you know, this is something I can relate to an extent. But Boy, I mean, if you know that you're going on to a greater reward, you're not willing to take someone else's time in order to extend your own, I think, at least I hope. But China being officially atheist is coming at this from a different perspective. A science fiction author that I whose work I've been a fan of for decades, Larry Niven, was writing about this in the 70s. He foresaw this coming, and he wrote about a phenomenon called organ legging, and even wrote in his series called the Known Space series of a practice that was government sanctioned, and where you begin with the prisoners convicted of capital crimes, and then you move to the prisoners who are in for life, and then you move to the prisoners who are just convicted of major felonies, and pretty soon you're down to the people with outstanding parking tickets as a source of raw material to extend life because people want to live forever. And I guess the question I have to ask is, are the recipients of these organs only Chinese citizens, or do we have people in the West who are traveling to China in order to get these organs?
People are traveling, and the phrase is transplant tourism, where there is no law in America to prevent or even advise anyone for or against going to China or other countries to get an organ. There was a report, in Australia there's been some studies done where they found, I'm not sure over what period of time it was, but 100 people over a period of time have gone to China to get their organs from Australia. We have a booklet that goes with the film Hard to Believe, and in here we have a little diagram. I'll just, there have been some studies in America, not many, but, you know, we have it. Actually, you can find us on the website, on the hardtobelievemovie.com website. So there was a study done at Mount Sinai Hospital. This was in the 2004 to 2006. There was 300 U.S. patients went to China to receive the transplants. They went abroad, but mostly got their organs from China. And in UCLA, they did a study on transplant tourism, and over a four-year period, 42% of the transplants of people leaving the country had got their transplants done in China. The Chinese hospitals have been advertising as early as even a year or two ago. They were advertising in a huge way before all these reports came out in English, advertising their hospitals, their services online, saying that you can get a liver in a week, and there's a guarantee. And we've heard anecdotally stories of people that have gone. The first liver didn't work, so they got another one while they were there. There was a heart surgeon from Europe, I believe Sweden, but he was definitely from Europe who was there, and they asked him, "Do you want to do the heart surgery in the morning or the evening?" And he said, and he refused to participate at that point. He said, I can't. If you can schedule it like that, there's something wrong." And he refused to participate. And that's the choices people have. They can say, okay, well, I'm just going to pretend nothing's wrong, but you know something is wrong. And you can pretend it's not wrong. And you can maybe ask a few questions, but unfortunately, it is a system that cannot be trusted. It is not transparent. It is run by a regime that does not value life. And at any point, if they can do that to their own citizens, what could they do to me or you?
Yeah.
It's really not a system that can be trusted, and that's been proven. Even in 2001, they vehemently denied that they were killing executed prisoners for their organs. And then in 2005, they admitted that 95% of their organs come from executed prisoners and that they've been doing this for a long time. So they proved that they completely lied. And it just keeps happening again and again. So it's a system that is not usable for us. And if we try and get into that system in any way, it's dangerous. So it's really important for people to know what they're getting into, to understand what this regime is, and to not put themselves at risk. I mean, whatever the risks are here, if you don't have, you need an organ. But even if you go there, there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee of the health and the success rate of those, that transplantation. There's many cases that have not been successful. So we really need to be looking at what we can do here to and prevent people going, or at least be aware of what's happening if they go over there. People need to know.
It's, well, I think just the moral component alone, knowing that this came up in another story recently. There has been a story in recent weeks of a gentleman from Russia who suffers from a severe spinal congenital degenerative disease, which has basically confined him to a wheelchair. And there's an Italian neurosurgeon who's claimed that he can take the gentleman's head and transplant it onto a new body. And most of the discussion has revolved around whether this will ever be successful or not. Most of the experts say this will only lead to, even if the patient survives, a new, I forget the way one doctor put it, but he said something like a new level of madness or something, because the neurological connections just won't match up the way they're supposed to. But the one question nobody's been asking, and a friend of mine pointed this out, well, where's the donor body coming from? And I think that's the question that needs to be asked whenever anybody is engaging in this type of transplant tourism. And again, knowing a couple of family members who perished for lack of, you know, one case of heart, another case kidneys, and knowing that those thoughts went through their minds, you know, gee, I wonder what it's like if I, you know, go to India. China wasn't even on the radar. They thought India was the place you had to go in order for this to happen. But then they ultimately decided against it because of the questions of safety and reliability. Again, the thought that these donor organs might not be willing donors never crossed their minds either. Since independent researchers like Ethan Gutman, for example, were able to come up with these numbers and document that this is going on, I have to believe that government intelligence agencies, whose job it is to know everything that's going on in places like China and Russia, know that this is going on. What does the U.S. government know, and what has been the reaction to the film Hard to Believe?
We believe they know a lot more than what they're letting on. And that the commercial interests are overpowering the human interests.
Our demand for cheap shoes and cheap electronics.
Yeah. Our debt to China, commercial. Unfortunately, that's the reality. We interviewed a few politicians for Hard to Believe. Well, let's say, okay, there has been some reaction. Hard to Believe it was released. It's been screening on PBS since last September, and now it's just released digitally on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and Vimeo. But during that time, we've had over 100 screenings worldwide now, plus broadcasts on PBS, and it's one piece of the puzzle. There's a lot of people that are active on this issue, but what we have seen is that this year, the U.S. Congress unanimously passed a resolution to condemn the practice of organ harvesting in China. Now, in Hard to Believe, we looked at a previous resolution that didn't even come up for vote, even though 285 members had co-sponsored that resolution. Now, we looked at why it didn't even come up for a vote. And one of the reasons we found it was that the political, commercial, trade interests and things were just getting it pushed aside, and the threat and pressure from the communist regime is real and it's strong. And they have such an abuse towards, especially people who practice Falun Gong, to push the government, the U.S. government, to not do something about it. But that resolution did pass this year. And so that is something pretty significant. It's not law binding in any way. It just sends a message that this is not tolerable. But the government, absolutely, it cannot be that they don't know what's going on in China, and that if they do know about it, if they want to find out more, they can absolutely find out more. As to why they're not doing more, why they're not putting in laws to stop people from going over, or prevent them from going over, or prevent perhaps like what Israel did, they prevented the government from paying for all the aftercare so that it's not on the taxpayers to pay for the aftercare of people going and doing this overseas. The American government can do that, but right now they haven't as yet. So I think they know what's going on. And for other reasons, there's other things that they're putting at a higher priority.
Well, again, and that's on us because if it wasn't for our demand for cheap shoes, cheap electronics, and the demand from people in the West for those organs, there would be no need to supply them.
If I could add to that too, sorry, it's not so. In addition, the other demand is education. So we are using education from China. There's we're training their doctors here, and we're educating their students here. They're bringing their education system into Confucius Institutes across the country that are run by the communist state.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, our students and children going through these, you know, soft power, whatever you want to call them, but it's not run by, you know, our government or education system here. It's from over there. So there's a lot of things that we're buying, giving back to China in exchange for it. So while we keep up this exchange and dialogue and not know who we're really dealing with, then
I'm sorry, we kind of glitched there. We missed a little bit of what you were saying at the end there. For some reason, our connection got a little wonky there. If you could go back to the beginning there, where you were just talking about the exchange of students and the educational system, the Confucius Institutes that they're setting up here. Again, for some reason, we lost about 15 seconds there, and I thought we dropped the connection entirely. Nope, looks like we did drop the connection again. it's pausing and freezing here on this side. Could be one of the fellows next door. One of the problems we run into is that we have to upload really large video files from time to time. We get a new show produced, we got to upload about like a 4 gigabyte file to our network. So could be one of the fellows is uploading a file in the next office, and I don't know about it. We could continue the conversation. I know this basically has only scratched the surface, but because of the connection here, maybe at this point it would be best to just wrap up and tell people where they can see the film. And I'll be talking with director Ken Stone. That program will be broadcast on the podcast and on the vidcast next week. Kay, if you could just let people know, where do they find out more information for their own research, and where do they watch the film?
Go to Hard Resources to find out all about the issue, and you can watch Hard to Believe from the website directly there. We have you can click to buy or rent it right from the homepage at hardtobelievemovie.com. If you prefer Amazon or iTunes, Amazon Instant Video, iTunes, we have the links right there on the homepage as well. So go to the home.
You'll find the link to the homepage for the film Hard to Believe in the show notes at vftb.net, and I'll, of course, put it in the show notes that accompany the video at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. I apologize for the tech issues during that program. Part of them were my fault. I didn't check to make sure that the audio was running through the mixing console to my right, which would have given you the full-bodied sound of this microphone on my side, but would also have improved the sound of coming through from Kay. But in addition to that, I mean, that just proves, it shows why engineers at all the radio stations I worked at during my career never let me touch anything except the on-off button for the microphone. Occasionally the volume slider, but that was about it. Also, we had some connection issues via Skype between our little patch of the Ozarks here and New York. So it wasn't the best connection, but I appreciate you struggling through to the end because this is an important topic. And next Sunday, you'll hear the interview with the director of Hard to Believe, Ken Stone, on how difficult it was to prepare this material and craft a narrative on this particular subject. It's distasteful. It's a story that I think people in the high levels of American government don't want getting out because it would make their jobs more difficult. We don't want to make the Chinese angry after all, since they own so much of our debt
and they produce so many of the goods that we consume here at some of our largest retail chains. But the fact is, the Chinese government is profiting from the sale of human organs that they are collecting from prisoners of conscience. And that is unconscionable. Other items to discuss in the news this week. You probably saw in the mainstream news reports, rather breathless, of strange radio signals. I've also seen it described as mysterious, as baffling, as freaky. The signal in question was collected from the star HD 164595. This is about 94 light years away in the constellation Hercules. A radio telescope in the Russian Republic of Karachay-Cherkessia collected this signal in May of 2015, but it is only now coming to the attention of researchers around the world. Well, the mainstream media, again, reported this as a potential extraterrestrial contact, and this is just feeding the meme that ET is out there and perhaps coming back. But when you dig a little bit into the story, first of all, the fact that they collected it last May and only are now releasing it in August of 2016, September of 2016, well, August, is curious. But when you start digging into it, researchers who are part of the SETI at Home project, these are people who volunteer processing cycles on their home computers to sift through radio signals detected by the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence and look for anomalies that might be of artificial origin. And researchers who know what they're talking about, posting at the SETI at Home forum, which is hosted on servers at Cal Berkeley, say it's, well, nothing to see here, basically. To summarize, a gentleman who describes himself as being part of this program for more than 16 years says, look, we believe a signal when it is persistent. It appears at the same spot in the sky in multiple observations. It only comes from one spot in the sky, and if we reobserve the target, the signal is still there. Things that add to believability, its frequency, period, and delay does not correspond to known interference. Its Doppler drift rate indicates that it is exactly frequency stable in the frame of the center of the mass of the solar system. I have to confess, I don't really know what that means. But it's, and finally, its properties, such as bandwidth, chirp rate, and or encoding, indicate intelligent design. Then this gentleman goes on to say, or to write, unfortunately, the observing method used by the Russian team does not permit many of these things to be determined. One, the signal was not persistent. Two, the signal was gone when the target was reobserved. Three, the signal frequency period delay cannot be determined. Four, the signal Doppler drift rate is unknown. And five, many sources of interference, including satellites, are present in the observing band. So basically, nothing to see here. The media is blowing this up out of proportion, which they do. And it is surprising how often this happens, that major media outlets that ought to know better are taking a bit of data, a bit of information, blowing it up into a full story. But that just is par for the course. They're competing for your eyeballs and mine, especially in this new journalism, the new world of journalism that is enabled by the internet. So just a reminder, don't believe everything you read. And for goodness sake, don't get your news from Facebook. Other things, and the other thing that this really brings to mind is this, and I, Sharon and I discussed this on Sci Friday this week. The fact that it's in the constellation Hercules is curious. Coincidental, probably. My talk at Morningside Church last week dealt with Elijah's confrontation with the priests of Baal, is the correct pronunciation, just for you scholars out there. Elijah versus the priests of Baal on Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel, another holy mountain that I should have included in my talk in July at the Rocky Mountain Prophecy Conference, but I already had seven holy mountains, and I like that number. Anyway, Mount Carmel, another holy mountain where a god of the mountain was worshipped. Carmel means vineyard of El, or vineyard of God, if you're Hebrew. But the Baal that was worshipped during the that period of history of the Northern Kingdom, this was during the reign of King Ahab, remember? And Ahab was married to Jezebel. Jezebel was the daughter of the king of Tyre. His name was Ethbaal, or Man of Baal. He was a priest of Astarte, better known as Ishtar, the Babylonian name. It goes all the way back to Sumer, Inanna, the goddess of sex and war. And by sex, I don't mean marital sex. I mean, you know, cult prostitute type sex. She was, Jezebel, was a very evangelistic, shall we say, about promoting the Canaanite cosmology, Canaanite religion, promoting the worship of the city god of Tyre. Now, the city god of Tyre was called Baal, but remember, that just means Lord, as, you know, as we call Yahweh, Lord. But his actual name in Canaanite, Ugaritic or whatever the language was, Canaanite, was Melkart. Melkart became the chief god of Tyre during the time of David and Solomon, under the reign of Hiram and his father, whose name I forget, but Hiram, the one who provided all of the goods for the construction materials for the temple. And this, boy, it just occurs to me. Hiram Abiff, Freemasons, Hiram provided, and Hiram creator of the worship of Melkart. Okay, something else for the book. Anyway, Melkart was just the Canaanite name for Heracles, a.k.a. Hercules. So the Baal that was worshipped by Jezebel and her father, and whose worship was introduced into the northern kingdom of Israel during the 9th century B.C., was very probably worship of Hercules. They were worshiping one of the Nephilim, because he was a son of Zeus, but Zeus was Baal, so he was also the son of Baal. So that, anyway, just kind of an interesting coincidence that this anomalous signal that's not really anomalous is coming from the constellation Hercules. I know it's a long way around to make a rather weak connection, but there it is. But this plays into the meme of the return of the old gods, which is a topic that we discussed on PID Radio from time to time. We talked about it a little more at length on Sci Friday, but because we're limited to 30 minutes, we can only go so far into the topic. But this is something that Tom Horn has been talking about for quite some time. Steve Quayle and others talking about sources inside the government, especially the military, who are convinced that the old Sumerian gods are returning. And when you get right down to it, Baal, just one of the old Sumerian gods, used to go by the name Ishkur, was the name to which under which he was introduced to the Sumerians by the Amorites. Well, I could spend an hour and a half on it like I did at Morningside, but I won't. The bottom line is that is a meme that has been pushed on the American public for quite some time, but certainly since the time of Aleister Crowley and H.P. Lovecraft with his Cthulhu mythos. I mean, a recurring theme in Lovecraftian fiction are these old gods who have just been sleeping, waiting for the stars to align properly so that they will return and destroy us all. The whole point of Peter Levenda's book, The Dark Lord, is that Crowley, Lovecraft were drawing from the same spiritual source identified by occultist Kenneth Grant, who was Crowley's successor as the head of the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis, as the god of chaos, Typhon. Well, Typhon was identified with Set, and Set was equated with Baal in the second millennium BC in northern Egypt. In fact, during the period of the sojourn in Egypt, while the Israelites were there in Egypt, Baal was worshipped by the kings of Egypt, northern Egypt. Egypt was split at that point, and northern Egypt was under the control of Semitic, or at least Semitic-speaking rulers called the Hyksos, and they were Baal worshippers. And again, they identified Baal as Set. Baal equals Set equals Zeus equals Jupiter equals Marduk. Same god, different names. But Set was also in the Egyptian pantheon equated with the Greek god of chaos, Typhon. And Kenneth Grant, who adapted the work of Crowley and his occult system called Thelema, adapted it into what he called the Typhonian tradition, essentially trying to summon the god of chaos, Typhon/Set, to return and become the god of the age. And if you look at the way the world is going the last decade or so, you could make a case that Typhon is, in fact, back. So, yeah, I know, strange connections, but when Sharon and I start talking, that's the kind of thing that we get into. Speaking of space exploration, by the way, and why does space exploration, backtracking for a second, have so many connections to pagan gods? I mean, I know Jack Parsons was a Crowley devotee, and he founded the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is now one of the key components of NASA and America's exploration efforts in outer space. But sometimes they do things that I'm sure are just intended to make conspiracy theorists, you know, sit up and take notice. Like a few years ago when the JPL directed a probe to smash into a comet named Temple. They smashed a probe into the comet just to see what would happen, I guess. They were going to get some data from the collision. And they collided on the 4th of July. Coincidence, right? I'm not much of a coincidence theorist. Anyway, everything in the solar system has got the name of a pagan god attached to it. The most recent project, OSIRIS-REx, or Osiris the King, which is being launched to examine an asteroid called Bennu. And the Bennu bird in Egyptian mythology was a god of, or was a bird connected to death and resurrection. It's the bird on which the Greeks based their myth of the phoenix, the bird that immolates and then arises from its own ashes. So Osiris the King is going to see the Bennu bird, which, again, they were connected in Egyptian cosmology because Osiris was the god of the dead. You know, why not scientific names instead of all of these pagan god names? Space connected to the return of the old gods. Crowley, Grant, Lovecraft, Parsons. It all seems connected and linked. Anyway, NASA's experiment to mimic life on Mars has ended. Six people lived in a dome on a remote location on the island of one of the Hawaiian islands for a whole year. Of course, they can only simulate it so much. The gravity is considerably higher than it was or will than it is on Mars, and in the back of your mind, you got to know that if something goes wrong, this is just a simulation. If the dome tears, we're not going to lose all of our oxygen and die. I guess you have to go through some simulation, some practice, just to see what problems might arise from keeping six people confined with one another for an entire year. I mean, there's got to be some psychological issues that arise there. So, but that just wrapped up on August the 28th. In Iceland, a big rock that is supposed to be enchanted was dug up by highway crews there because they determined that the rock was the home of elves who were angry that the rock had been buried, and it was causing problems. There were things going badly for the highway crew over the past year since the rock was buried. So apparently, belief in elves is very strong in Iceland. And I think this just proves that as we move deeper into a post-Christian world, here, even in the scientistic West, it's not going to become an age of reason and atheism. We're just going to return to the old gods. Again, the same theme. So anyway, this rock has been dug up and pressure washed to appease their elven lords. Military officer, the number 2 ranking officer in the United States Army, the United States military, he's actually an Air Force general, so forgive me. General Paul Selva said that last week that he believes we're facing a situation where one of our adversaries may develop a lethal autonomous weapons system soon. I talk about this periodically. Laws or killer robots or the Terminator scenario, if you will, is something that the Pentagon is very concerned about. Not coincidentally, Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis, who I am honored to call a friend, has just issued a new book. In fact, it's at the printers now. I've got my review copy that I'll be reading this Labor Day weekend. And months ago, I am told he said to Tom Horn, his publisher, this is something that we're talking about inside the Pentagon. I can't tell you everything that I know, but this is something that is becoming a real issue for military planners. And Tom said, you need to write that book. And so the forthcoming book called Future Wars will deal with cyber soldiers, super soldiers, terminators, lethal autonomous weapon systems, enhanced human capabilities, and so forth. That book will be out by October, and you'll get an opportunity to see and hear from Colonel McGinnis on Skywatch TV and other programs as the book is released. Very impressed with his previous book, Never Submit. Did a lot of really good research on Islam. It was not just a, you know, let's bash the Muslims for the sake of bashing Muslims. He actually dug into the their belief systems and consulted some scholarly authorities on what they believe and how that affects the psychology of and their society. So I think this is a book to watch and pick up once it becomes available. Future War by Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. Our political situation in the Middle East continues to deteriorate. It's getting ridiculous. Where in Syria last week, it became public that sides that we are backing, we're backing both sides of a fight in the civil war in Syria. You know, the Turks are our allies. They're part of NATO, so we are obligated by treaty to defend them in case of attack, which is why their spat with Russia was so nerve-wracking. But we are also allied with the Kurds, and the Kurds in northern Syria and northern Iraq have been the most effective military force in fighting the Islamic State over the past 2 years. Well, last week, Turkey launched an invasion into northern Syria to clear the city of Jarablus along the border, but then they're driving further south toward the city of Manbij, where the Kurds had taken control. And an all-out firefight opened up between the Turks and the Kurdish YPG militia forces. Vice President Biden went to Turkey, shook hands with President Erdogan, and apparently decided to the administration had decided to throw the Kurds under the bus, because Vice President Biden issued a public statement calling on the Kurds to withdraw east of the Euphrates River, leave their positions, withdraw east of the river, or they wouldn't receive any further support from the U.S. So we're backing the Turks. We're backing the Syrian Defense Forces, the SDF militia, of which the Kurds are really the major part of it. But we're telling them to back off and get away from the Turks. I mean, the Turks don't want the Kurds linking up. There's a pocket in northwest Syria, and they don't want that pocket linked up with the Kurdish positions that basically control most of northern Iraq, because they're afraid the Kurds would take this semi-autonomous region and declare an independent state, which would then give the Kurds in Turkey, they comprise, what, about 20% of the Turkish population? And they basically are in the majority of southeast Turkey. Hope that they could declare their own state within a state, you know, within Turkey. So it's an ugly situation. But again, we are backing both sides in this fight, and both of those sides are fighting each other instead of the Islamic State, which is absolutely insane. And Turkey, by the way, holds the trump card here. I mean, if we try to compel them to do what we want them to do, remember, they've got about 2 million Syrian refugees that they are keeping inside their borders for now. They're also trying to pressure the EU to allow Turkish citizens to travel without visas throughout the European Union. The EU doesn't want to allow that, but if Erdogan wants, they could just open the gates and let these 2 million refugees head for the West. And we also know that a number of them have false passports and papers provided by the Islamic State, just what we need. Things in Calais are getting really ugly. Calais is that part of France on their end of the tunnel that goes underneath the English Channel. And migrants there at a place called The Jungle, which locals were told by politicians would never house more than 2,000 refugees at most, has got 9,000 and growing. There's a church there, a mosque there, there's a theater there, beauty parlor. It basically has turned into a city made of tents. But there's nothing for the young, healthy men to do, so they've been taking bats and knives and smashing up cars on the roads in Calais just for fun. And the response of the government in Calais is to avoid the roads. Avoid the roads. Does this make any sense to you? Well, we better consider the implications of this, because if the current administration and potentially the next administration look to import more migrants from the Middle East, this could be coming to a town near you. A problem in South Carolina, millions of bees have died there. And you know, at first, the thought was that it was colony collapse disorder, something we talked about. We haven't talked about much lately, but it hasn't gone away. But this was different from colony collapse disorder. CCD, the hive just flies away, basically leaving a live queen and a few drones. In this case, they're just dead bees all over the place. Dorchester County in South Carolina, you know, worker bees just all over farms in the area. Apparently what happened was the county there sprayed for mosquitoes, trying to prevent the spread of the Zika virus, which a new story this week shows there's a strong link between Zika and Guillain-Barre syndrome. I'm not pronouncing that correctly, I know, but you can understand why the government wants to prevent the spread of Zika-carrying mosquitoes, which are now in Florida. But as a consequence of the spraying, they just at one location, Flowertown Bee and Farm Supply in Somerville, South Carolina, 46 hives killed. That's about 2.5 million bees. Back to politics for a minute. President Obama in China this weekend for the kickoff of the G20 summit. And there is some thought that he will personally, or that he will take the opportunity to announce with the with President Xi of China, ratification of the Paris Climate Accord. Now, how can he do this without a vote in the Senate? That's a really good question, because the Senate under the Constitution is required to approve foreign treaties by a two-thirds majority. He knows he won't get it, but the White House has decided to take the same tack that they used with the Iran nuclear deal, which is to declare it an executive agreement. In other words, because it's not a treaty, they don't need to put it before the Senate for a vote, even though this would basically subject the United States economy to draconian restrictions on carbon emissions. The president intends to just enact this unilaterally, simply by calling it an executive agreement. Isn't it amazing how this administration seemingly can push things down the throats of the American voters? I mean, the Affordable Care Act, a bank bailout, General Motors bailout, Chrysler bailout, all things that about 60 to 65% of us opposed, the Iran nuclear deal, and now the Paris Climate Accord. And yet, when it comes to foreign policy, they seem impotent. It's mind-boggling, but that appears to be the we should get used to the pattern, because this is what it will be like under a one world government. No real clout on the world stage, but no authority at the local level to do anything that we would, you know, it would be best for our local communities. Another story in South Carolina that we've been watching, and this is there's a follow up from Ohio. There was a story that popped up this past week about reports in Greenville County, South Carolina, and that caught my attention because we have relatives there, that person or persons dressed in clown masks were trying to lure children into the woods. Now, Columbus, Ohio authorities reported that a person in a clown mask chased a 14-year-old boy with a knife. This would be about 6:15 on a school day, 6:15 in the morning. So Kind of a bizarre trend. There was a story a few weeks back about a creepy clown calling himself Gags who was spotted at various locations around Green Bay, Wisconsin. Turned out that was just a social media marketing campaign for a forthcoming short film. But what's going on in Greenville? What's going on in Columbus, Ohio? Apparently not a joke. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, well, another part of the discussion about this film, the documentary Hard to Believe, Ken Stone, the director. We will feature that interview next Sunday, September the 11th. This coming Wednesday, speaking of Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis, the interview recorded with Colonel McGinnis and our friend Gary Stearman of Prophecy Watchers at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. You will hear those interviews, the video, of course, being saved for the release of the conference DVD set. But you'll hear those interviews on Wednesday, September 7th. And then on the 14th, a couple of folks we know very, very well, Josh Peck and my best friend, Sharon K. Gilbert. The discussions I had with them out at the Colorado Conference, those will be posted here on September the 14th. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, we get back to the back in the routine this coming Sunday. We missed this past week because of our trip down to Blue Eye for my talks at Morningside, but we will get the Old Testament, New Testament studies posted by midday Sunday at gilberthouse.org. And beginning Labor Day Monday this week, begin spinning out the audio version of my novel, The God Conspiracy, read by the author, posting those as videos, be posting those as YouTube videos. But if you want to just log onto the website, which will go live this weekend, it is The God Conspiracy, all one word, thegodconspiracy.tk, thegodconspiracy.tk. And of course, if you subscribe to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, you'll be notified every time we post a new episode in The God Conspiracy, a political conspiracy supernatural thriller. This will take several months to get all the way through the book, but we had the audio and our friend Jake Rahutsky has videoized them, if that's a word, and we will be spinning those out via YouTube at the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. Next week on Skywatch TV, we begin the first of 3 weeks' worth of interviews with Rabbi Jonathan Kahn. His new book called The Book of Mysteries, a very interesting presentation. It's 365 chapters, each one examining a different mystery of the Bible. You read it as a devotional. You can read it as a story. It's told in a fictional format, much like the Harbinger. And the interviews with Rabbi Kahn were fascinating. Josh Peck joined me for those. You'll see the first of those beginning Sunday morning on Skywatch TV. To find out where and when you can watch Skywatch TV, log on to skywatchtv.com and then click the top menu bar where it says Channels. Thank you for your reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you find us on the web. And again, if you're watching, we appreciate that. Please subscribe, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. Every time we post a new interview or episode of The God Conspiracy beginning Monday, you'll get a notification via email. And we discuss the issues we bring up here on the program at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution non-commercial, no derivatives, 4.0 international license. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.